This is the October 15th Neurology Podcast. I'm Stacey Clardy, section editor of the podcast. This week's featured interview highlights an article from a seven-year population-based study on orthostatic hypotension in Parkinson's disease. For the What's Trending feature, you'll hear the first half of an interview with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Stanley Prusner, and part two of that discussion with Dr. Prusner will air next week. It's fantastic. Take a listen.
Hi, this is Jeff Ratliff from Jefferson University in Philadelphia. For this week's Neurology Podcast, I'm talking with Dr. Ylva Hjorth from the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehab in Stavanger University in Norway. Ylva and her colleagues did a study on orthostatic hypotension in Parkinson's disease, a seven-year prospective population-based study that will be published in this week's Journal of Neurology. In this study, Ylva and her colleagues measured orthostatic blood pressure in a cohort of 185 newly diagnosed Parkinson's disease patients and 172 matched controls. They repeated these measurements at visits over the next 7 years, and they examined the incidence of development of orthostatic hypotension and looked at the factors associated with its development. Thanks for joining us today, Ylva.
Thank you for having me, Jeffrey.
So let's just jump in, and can you briefly just tell us, what did the study teach us about the incidence of orthostatic hypotension in the Parkinson's disease population?
Sure. So we learned that orthostatic hypotension is very common in patients with Parkinson's disease from the earliest stages. We found that compared to controls, orthostatic hypotension was more common in patients with Parkinson's disease at all visits. When we looked at these 185 patients at baseline when newly diagnosed and drug naive, about 20% had orthostatic hypotension, and this was a threefold higher relative risk as compared to the controls. When we looked at that using data collected longitudinally, we found that as many as 65%, almost two-thirds of the patients, had orthostatic hypotension during the first 7 years of Parkinson's disease. For the clinician, the important part is that orthostatic hypotension is very common already from the very first visit, and that the symptoms may be more subtle, especially during the first years after diagnosis, but become more severe or clinically significant in almost one-third of the patients during the first 7 years after diagnosis.
So we learned that it's common even right after diagnosis, and the severity may increase or change over at least the first 7 years as we studied it here. For those of our listeners who see Parkinson's disease patients, they probably recognize that the symptoms of orthostatic hypotension can be myriad and not always straightforward. So what sort of symptoms do you think are helpful for them to screen for in Parkinson's disease patients when they come into the office?
Yeah, that is a good question. And I realize that available time during an office visit varies from country to country. But what we basically would suggest to do first is to ask about previous blood pressure measurements or blood pressure abnormalities, and if the patient has experienced symptoms like lightheadedness, dizziness, passing out, fatigue, nausea, blurred vision, confusion, and even soreness in the neck and shoulders, gait instability and falls, just to mention some.
And I think that's important. I've learned from seeing my own Parkinson's patients that you're right. It's not always a classic stand up quickly, get lightheaded, but patients may be a lot more vague about the symptoms they're experiencing, confusion, kind of a vague pain across the back of the neck and the shoulders, and getting that history, like you said, of is it provoked by either standing up or after prolonged standing that makes you think that maybe it is position dependent. You looked at demographic and other clinical features of the cohort as it relates to the development of orthostatic hypotension. What did we learn from this study about whether there are certain patients or patients with certain clinical features that should prompt us to be extra diligent in our screening for orthostatic hypotension?
When we considered baseline data only, we found that among patients with Parkinson's disease, those with orthostatic hypotension were older than those without, while all other demographics and clinical characteristics were similar between groups. When we looked at features that were associated with orthostatic hypotension over time, in this case over the entire seven-year study period, we confirmed this finding and also found that patients with orthostatic hypotension were more likely to have a lower mini mental state examination score, which we used as a measure of global cognitive function. And last but not least, with higher levodopa dose. So our findings indicate that patients with these features, older age, impaired cognition, postural instability or gait problems, and use of higher levodopa dose are perhaps those we should screen carefully.
Understood. So folks who have some gait instability to begin with, some cognitive symptoms, or who we've had to increase to a significantly higher dose of levodopa, we should be watching out for those side effects. In those patients, or even in all of our patients, how do you recommend our neurology listeners screen for orthostatic hypotension in Parkinson's patients? Should it be a combination of screening through history gathering, like we discussed about asking about symptoms? Should all patients who come into the office have sitting or supine and standing blood pressures measured while they're there in the office?
Well, to diagnose orthostatic hypotension, we need to measure the blood pressure during a head-up tilt test or a supine standing test. And these do take quite some time when assessed properly. So a pragmatic solution to a very real time dilemma during office visits is to target this assessment for a selected patient group to measure blood pressure if we suspect orthostatic hypertension, based upon the information we get through our history gathering and also recalling what we just talked about, that older patients with impaired cognition, postural instability, or gait problems using higher levodopa doses are more likely to have orthostatic hypertension. Now, the results from our study suggest that these symptoms following low blood pressure may be subtle and therefore easy to miss, especially during the earliest disease stages. So one take-home message is that we should probably be more aware of orthostatic hypotension as a common non-motor symptom whilst taking the medical history of patients with Parkinson's disease, and perhaps also lower the threshold for assessing and monitoring this blood pressure abnormality.
And I think that's important, recognizing that there may be patients who do have measured orthostatic hypotension when we do check sitting and standing blood pressures, even if they're not having symptoms, but maybe we have to be extra vigilant about asking them about symptoms and seeing if it becomes clinically significant. In those patients who describe symptoms or who have maybe a measurement of a drop in blood pressure who don't have symptoms, is there a point at which you recommend intervening for a certain patient's orthostatic hypotension? How would you outline for our audience a strategy regarding when do you treat, and if you decide to treat, when do you reach for a non-pharmacologic intervention versus when do you reach for a medication?
In short, I would recommend to treat when orthostatic hypotension bothers the patient, for example, when it has an impact of activities of daily living, or if they report self-imposed limitations in daily life due to the symptoms we talked about earlier. We know that patients with Parkinson's disease in general are more sedentary, and therefore minimizing or avoiding low blood pressure may help them to stay active and independent for a longer time. So treatment or not depends on the symptoms, and what treatment to choose depends on the main reasons for the low blood pressure. So a systematic approach using three treatment steps may be one way to go. First of all, review all medications. When low blood pressure is caused by medications, treatment usually involves changing the dose of the medication, replacing it, or stopping it entirely. So have a look at high blood pressure medications, diuretics, antidepressants, and of course Parkinson's disease medications, particularly levodopa. Secondly, try non-pharmacological therapies such as increased water and salt intake, compression devices, drinking little or no alcohol, avoiding overheating, raise the head of the bed at night, and engage in regular physical exercise.
Great, thank you. I think that's really helpful for our listeners. I wanted to thank Ilva for joining us today. I want to encourage our listeners to go check out her study in this week's issue of Neurology. Again, the title of her article is Orthostatic Hypotension in Parkinson's Disease, a 7-year prospective population-based study. Thanks again, Ilva.
It's been a pleasure, Jeffrey.
This is Jason Crowell with the Neurology Podcast, and it is my great honor today to welcome a very special guest to our podcast, Dr. Stanley Prusner. Dr. Prusner is best known for his discovery of an unprecedented class of pathogens that we now know as prions. This was an accomplishment that led to many prizes and awards throughout his career. Most notably, he was the sole recipient of the 1997 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. He is the director of the Institute for Neurodegenerative Diseases, and he's also professor of neurology and biochemistry at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Prusner, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us today.
You're most welcome.
I guess the place to start is back at the beginning. So what made you start studying prions and prion diseases?
Well, I didn't start with prions. I didn't know what I was going to study. But I had a patient with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease as a resident. And that patient fascinated me when Dick Meringer, who was the attending neurologist, started to tell me about all of the background of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease and the transmission of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease from people to monkeys. And that had been preceded by studies on Kuru by Carlton Gajicek, Joe Gibbs, and Michael Alpers, who a couple of years earlier in 1966 had transmitted the disease into chimpanzees. My own studies, really, and my own interest began as a resident in 1972 when the patient from Marin County, a 60-year-old woman, presented with difficulties with complex tasks such as putting her golf balls into a golf bag or a little zippered case, with putting her car key into the car door and opening the door, and then taking the key out and inserting it into the ignition and turning on the motor. So these were complicated for her, and over a period of a few weeks, she became almost mute. And to see this beautiful woman ravaged by this disease that was tearing her brain apart, there was no sign of a fever, there was no increased white cell count in her blood, her spinal fluid was normal, and no one really had any clear reason why this should happen except that her clinical signs were similar to those that had been seen in other patients for the previous 65 years, and the disease was called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So as I puzzled over this, and I learned more and more about a similar disease called scrapie of sheep and goats, I was just captured by what in the world could be happening to this poor woman when it didn't seem like there was a virus, bacterium, a fungus that was destroying her brain. And people thought that the scrapie agent, since about 1960, was something that was transmissible and something that had an odd flavor to it in the sense that it was resistant to ionizing and UV radiation that killed viruses, that killed bacteria, that killed fungi. And it was really an unknown. And I thought, what a wonderful problem to study. So that's how it all began.
I'm curious, where do you begin? How do you even decide where to jump into a problem like that?
Well, a lot of this is described in a book that I wrote that was published a few years ago called Madness and Memory. So for those people who want to know the details, you can look them up. But the short answer is that you say, okay, there's a substance that is an unknown, and I've got to figure out what is it. Is it made of nucleic acid? Is it DNA or RNA? Is it made of protein? Is it made of carbohydrate? Is it something we've never seen before? And so you need to try to purify it. And fortunately, I had a lot of experience at the NIH before this residency in neurology, purifying proteins that were in minute quantities. And that experience really was a primer for doing what I set out to do, which was to purify the scrapie agent, which could be measured in these what I call horrible mouse assays that took about a year and 60 mice to quantify one sample. So with that, I began. And it became very clear to me after a couple of years that I was unlikely to make enough progress to ever get tenure. But fortunately, there was a new approach, and it was with hamsters. And there was one isolate of the scrapie agent that caused the hamsters to get sick in 70 days. The titer, the amount of the scrapie agent, was about 1,000 times more than what was found in the mouse. And that seemed to be a great place to start. And then I was able to reduce the number of animals from 60 down to 4 and still be able to measure the amount of the scrapie agent. And that's where the whole thing started to explode. And I could explore possibilities for nucleic acid, for proteins. But the key was to constantly enrich and remove 99.9% of the contaminants. And once I had those kinds of preparations, I could destroy proteins and kill the scrapie activity. But when I tried to kill nucleic acids, I found that there was no procedure that targeted nucleic acids that would kill the scrapie agent. So I said, well, maybe it's time to stop calling this an agent, because there are lots of agents, and it needs a word. And I spent a while thinking about that. And it was the spring of 1981 that I came up with the word prion, and I derived it from protein and infectious, and moved a couple letters around. because I had said to myself, I need something, a word that has five letters or less, and it had to have a reasonable sound, and it had to be easy to pronounce. So when I stumbled across Prion, I thought, that looks good, that sounds good, and that's how it came to be.
Was there a close runner-up to what you settled on, Prion?
Yeah, so I had protein and infectious, and then I had the word agent involved. And when I was still using agent, I came up with PF, and I liked the word PF because it was four letters. I liked Edith Piaf, and of course, PF means sparrow in French, and I thought that was a good one. But one of my friends, Sidney Udenfriend, who is the director of the Roche Institute for Molecular Biology, which has now disappeared long ago, and had been at the NIH when I was there, I sent him the paper, and he called me up, and he said, Stan, what is going on here? This is an American discovery, not a French discovery, because PF means sparrow, and of course Edith Piaf was a very famous singer. So he said, you need to start over. And so I dumped that word. So that was the previous word.
It's well known that you faced significant skepticism as you began to report your work. Can you give us a sense of what it was like to continue on in spite of scientists who were doubting the work you were doing?
Well, I'd written a lot of papers by the time I started this work. I'd written 26 scientific papers, and I had done a lot of work during medical school and then at the NIH for 3 years. And I felt that I knew how to do research. I knew that I would never publish anything that I hadn't done three times. Everything was my three times rule. I tried to use statistics whenever I could. And I tried to be very careful about what I said that I thought was accurate and what was not. And I constantly worried that I was going to go down the wrong path. I was going to end up in a cul-de-sac. I was not going to find my way out scientifically. And that was going to be the end of my scientific career. And I really liked doing science. I thought, what an incredible occupation to get paid to come to work and solve a puzzle every day. But it's the same puzzle. It's not a crossword puzzle where you come up with the word and you go on to the next word. This is one gigantic puzzle in life. It's enormous, and you just keep going. And you've got to throw away all the garbage, and you've got to get to the essence, and you keep going. And I just thought, wow, what a privilege this is. So I was fairly sure that I knew what I was doing. But I was always worried that I might end up out on a tree overhanging the Pacific, and that all of a sudden I was going to end up in the water because I took one wrong step. So I was nervous about all of this. But the people who were angry, that was another issue. And, you know, I just ignored them and went on. And I would get into arguments with them, and I would hold my ground, and they never had an argument that would turn me off or send me away and say, gee, you know, maybe they're right and I'm wrong. And I also needed a job. I didn't have a trust fund, so to speak, that was going to pay me if I just walked away from the whole thing and I could spend 3 years retooling or doing something else. I had no choice, but I needed to make a living. And I enjoyed science so much that I kind of just powered through it.
Did you ever seriously consider abandoning this line and jumping over to some other line of research?
Well, I had done a lot of research on glutamate metabolism in E. coli. And when I first started talking about scrapie to people, everybody said to me, almost to the last person, you ought to work on glutamate metabolism in the brain. You should move from bacteria to the brain. There's a ton of glutamate and glutamine. That's where you should focus. The deeper I got into the studies of scrapie and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, the more fascinated I became. And I kept saying, why would I return to something as dull as an amino acid? This problem is a gift, and I need to take advantage of it. So I was not deterred from staying focused.
Would you mind sharing with us what the experience was like in 1997 when you learned you'd been awarded the Nobel Prize?
Well, I'm off in Washington, D.C. at a meeting of the FDA, and I'm staying in this horrible little room at a Holiday Inn, and it was really a dump. And that room was even worse than many of the other rooms in that hotel. I don't know why I ended up in such a bad place, but I did. And I got this call. This is Niels Ringert. I'm calling you from the Nobel Committee for Nobel Assembly. I knew Niels Ringert. I had met him once. I'd had dinner with him 6 months earlier in Stockholm. And he said, well, we've just finished our deliberations, and we have given you the Nobel Prize for physiology or medicine. And we hope that you can make arrangements to come to Stockholm and receive the prize in December. This was the beginning of October. And I listened and I said, yeah, I can show up. And he says to me, we decided to give you the whole prize. And I said, you got to be kidding me. And I thought, wow. So then we go a little further. He says, you remember me? I said, yeah, sure. We ate at this restaurant in the old town. And he said, that's right. And I said, and that was last year, December. And he said, well, some people think that it's not me when I call. And I said, well, I remember your voice. He said, you shouldn't talk to anybody now. You should wait. And that's because we need to have this press release and announce it before you start calling people and talking to them. So give us about 3 hours. And I said, okay. I now turn on the TV because I want to see what's happening. And there's nothing on TV about this. And the hours go by. And it's about 7 a.m. Eastern time. And I said, I should turn on the radio because I'm not getting anywhere with the TV. And believe it or not, there was actually a radio in this room. I mean, when have you seen a radio in a hotel room recently? And on the radio, it said, oh, this is ABC News, and it's 7 a.m., and Stanley Prusiner has just won the Nobel Prize. And I said, oh, my God, it's real. So, yeah, it was great. I would recommend this to anybody. There's nothing negative about this happening to you.
Terrific. Wonderful advice. Thank you. I imagine that this has to be a watershed moment in your career, obviously, and it's been 22 years. When you reflect back your career prior to winning this prize versus the 22 years since then, how have things changed?
You know, of course, everybody wants to talk about the Nobel Prize. It's not a negative thing to do, so you do it. But you become a little more confident. And one of the things the committee said to me, we had a dinner one night, and so it was just the committee and a few other people, and they said to me, we hope that this prize will help you with your fundraising so you can get the money you need to go on with your research. One of the things you have to face after you get a Nobel Prize is, what do I do next? And you say to yourself, do I really want to be the president of a university? Do I want to be a dean of a medical school? Do I want to run for Congress? And even now you would say, oh, well, maybe I should run for president because there's a hell of a lot of people out there doing this and I might do a better job than a lot of these people. Or should I just continue to do science because there's a lot of important problems, especially in the world of neurodegeneration. And so that's what I settled on. And I spent the better part of 10 years working out the details of small compounds that would cross the blood-brain barrier, get into the brain, and would extend the lives of animals with scrapie. So that's what I did. And then I said, okay, now I'm ready to move into the world of the big diseases, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And that's what I've been doing over the last 10 years. And now we're making really big progress in this. And I'm very, very happy that I've done that. I work on this every single day, 7 days a week. And I'm doing what I love. And I'm very fortunate.
We'll stop the discussion there for this week, but there is a lot more great discussion next week when Jason Crowell continues talking with Stanley Prusiner about his latest research on prion diseases, including expanding his work to Alzheimer's disease. Thanks for listening, and see you next week. This is Stacey Clardy. Please check out this week's journal, featuring an interesting article on how amyloid and cerebrovascular burden divergently influence brain functional network changes over time. There's also a great article describing how pediatric postoperative cerebellar cognitive affective syndrome follows outflow pathway lesions. And don't forget to take a look at neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. As well as the mini sites, there's one on equity, diversity, and inclusion, one on global neurology, and another on innovations in care delivery. Thank you for listening. The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.